creation of the American Republic, with its written constitution and guarantees of personal natural liberty, is the greatest political accomplishment in the history of the Western world. Unfortunately, almost from the very beginning of the creation of the Republic, those elected to preserve the Constitution began to dismantle it. In virtually every administration, the government has sought ingenious ways to evade and avoid its obligations under our founding charter. But a little bit of background first. When we were colonists and the king and the parliament wanted to raise money, one of the ways they did it was by the use of the Stamp Act. The Stamp Act required of colonists, not of people in the motherland, that they have on every official piece of paper in their home, every book, every pamphlet, every deed, every mortgage, every lease, even a poster to be nailed to a tree, the king's stamp, which bore an image of the king. Question: how did the king's government know if you had his image on your papers in your house? Answer: Parliament enacted the Writs of Assistance Act, a damnable piece of legislation that allowed British soldiers to write their own search warrants. So a British soldier could show up at your front door and authorize himself in writing to examine the contents of your home, your barn, your property, ostensibly looking for the king's stamps. Of course, if they happened to find rum imported from the islands without a tax stamp on it, or furniture that had been imported from Great Britain, and you couldn't prove the tax was paid on it, the rum and the furniture would be seized and you would be carted away. The Stamp Act and the Writs of Assistance Act were among the last straws. In fact, the Stamp Act was so controversial that Parliament eventually rescinded it in an effort to quell the uproar on this side of the pond, but it didn't work. We wrote a Declaration of Independence. The great Thomas Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence with some editing from some of his political enemies, but it stands for the affirmation of the natural rights of human beings, because it says we are endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among them is life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We fought a revolution, we won the revolution, we wrote the Constitution. The whole purpose of the Constitution is to keep the government in check, to divide and diffuse power between the states and the central government, and further divide it and check it within the federal government itself. Much of the planning and the ideas behind the Constitution came from Greek and Latin and Roman, and to a certain extent even British experience. In the summer of 1787, in a swampy area of the city of Brotherly Love, the founding fathers debated, where do our rights come from? Jefferson, who was not there, Madison, who was there, argued that our rights come from our humanity, and our humanity is a gift from God, and that rights like freedom of speech and freedom of the press and freedom of association and freedom of travel and freedom of thought and freedom to develop your personality and the right to privacy are natural human rights that are as natural to us as the fingers on the ends of our hands. That because God is perfectly free and because we are created in His image and likeness, He imbued in each and every one of us the same natural desires for and right to freedom that he has. Hamilton and Adams, the big government guys, said that's a lot of baloney, because you can't have rights without a government to protect them. You only have the rights that the government lets you have. And our rights, therefore, come from the government. They don't come from our nature. It's clear from reading the document, the Constitution, that it is intended by the language in the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments which were added in the next 3 or 4 years, that it is Jefferson and Madison who carried the day, that the whole purpose of the document is to guarantee that our rights exist. Example, the First Amendment doesn't say the government shall give you freedom of speech. It says Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. This presumes that freedom of speech pre-exists Congress and it came from somewhere else, from our humanity. But none of this was new. The one thing that was new about the Constitution is the Fourth Amendment. The Fourth Amendment, which Justice Brandeis said is the right to be left alone, the greatest right of all the rights in civilized society, the right most valued by human beings. Today we call it the right to privacy. Here's what it means. It means that the government can't come and break down your door in the middle of the night like in the banana republics. It must go to a judge, and it must present to a neutral judge what the document, what the Fourth Amendment calls probable cause, a phrase meaning it is more likely than not that in that house where we want to seize that person or that document, there is evidence of a crime. So no matter how guilty is the government's target, the Fourth Amendment puts a neutral judge between the government and the target. No matter who the target is, no matter what the target has done, no matter how guilty is the target, no matter how widespread is the belief in the guilt of the target, no matter how accurate is the belief in the guilt of the target, no matter how much the society fears the target, the government must go through a neutral judge before it can get to that target. Unfortunately, we have allowed the government, a monopoly on the use of force in our society. The Fourth Amendment regulates that monopoly because no one could be trusted with the power to use unregulated force. And it is the Fourth Amendment that was intended forever to keep us from becoming what our cousins in Eastern Europe would become at the end of World War II. Now, almost from the very beginning, we'll give George Washington a break. He had enough to do setting up the basic guidelines. In the administration of John Adams, remember the contested election, they didn't run on tickets in those days. The president was John Adams. He was the biggest of the big government guys. The vice president was Thomas Jefferson. They didn't agree on anything. Adams defeated Jefferson for president in the Electoral College, and the original Constitution said the number one person becomes president, the number two becomes vice president. Adams thought there was too much freedom in the United States. The country was 8 years old when the Adams administration enacted the Alien and Sedition Acts, which, among other things, made it a crime punishable by 2 years in jail to criticize or to demean in public the president, members of the president's cabinet, or members of Congress. Note who was omitted from its protections. The vice president. They were happy to have TJ criticized all he could tolerate. And unfortunately, we laugh about it now, it's such a historical abomination. Unfortunately, the federal government actually prosecuted people, and juries convicted them, and judges incarcerated them for doing what we broke away from England to have the right to do, criticize or demean the government. That is the first serious assault on civil liberties waged in a formal way by the government. I'm not talking about a runaway sheriff, or a crazy FBI agent, or a goofy U.S. Marshal, or someone who should never have been given the shield and the gun of the government. I'm talking about the power of the federal government aimed and targeted at people who would criticize it. When Jefferson became president and it expired, that is the Alien and Sedition Acts, he basically said, don't even send it to my desk because I'm not going to sign a renewal. He didn't have to say that because by then the anti-federalists, those who believed that our rights were natural, those who believed that the states were sovereign, those who believed that the federal government only had the 17, count them, 17 specific, discrete, unique, precise powers that the Constitution gave it. So by Jefferson saying to people of that mindset, don't send me the Alien and Sedition Acts, it was redundant. He wasn't going to sign it, and they weren't going to send it to him. It expires during his presidency in 1805. My friend Bob Higgs has written a great book called The Warfare State, in which he argues that war is the health of the state, that in times of war, the government gets stronger because we let it do so. The next massive assault on civil liberties comes during the Civil War. Now, I come not to talk about Lincoln. I could talk about him for a month, about the massive violations of the Constitution. When one of Gillespie's people interviewed me and asked me, who is the greatest violator of the Constitution? I said, George W. Bush has shown less fidelity to the Constitution than any president since Abraham Lincoln. And they said, Lincoln? And I said, yes, Lincoln. Lincoln slaughtered 650,000 Americans. Where's the power to do that in the Constitution? Lincoln locked up editors of newspapers in the North, not in the South that was rebelling, but in the North because they criticized him. Lincoln had soldiers break down the door of the house of a Republican congressman from Ohio, Clement Vallandigham, because Vallandigham called Lincoln a monster and a tyrant, which he was, and had him banished to Canada for the balance of the Civil War. And of course, Lincoln, never mind what his soldiers did to women in the South, never mind what they did to banks and courthouses in the South that burnt them down, Lincoln suspended the writ of habeas corpus. Well, habeas corpus has been around since 1215, since King John reluctantly signed the Magna Carta. He agreed that no matter how powerful the government and no matter how awful its target, the target could always compel the government to bring the target before a neutral judge and justify the target's incarceration. Lincoln, on a whim and by himself, suspended that. In the First World War, the Congress enacted the Espionage Acts. The Espionage Acts, one of which is still extant, makes it a crime to discourage workers in munitions plants from going to work. Hey, Dad, you don't look so good today. Stay home. I'm really saying that because I'm against the war and I want a few thousand fewer bullets manufactured today. A guy by the name of Abe Gitlow is the first target of the government in a very, very famous case because he distributed leaflets that he printed by himself in a tenement in the Lower East Side of Manhattan in which he encouraged munitions workers not to go to work. The leaflets were written in Yiddish. And Mr. Gitlow served 10 years in a federal prison for dropping them out of his window from a Lower East Side tenement. When Alberto Gonzalez threatened the New York Times about a year and a half ago, he cited the Espionage Act because it is still a law in your country's law books and mine that would permit the government to prosecute someone who encouraged workers not to produce what the government needs for war. What part of Congress shall make no law did they not understand? In World War II, of course, we had FDR. Put aside the socialist monstrosity that he visited upon us, which is everywhere around this building. He locked up 10,000 Italian Americans and 110,000 Japanese Americans. Not Japanese from Japan or Italians from Italy, but people born in the United States as American as he was because of their ancestry. And the Supreme Court permitted him to do so. His argument was that they were a security threat. So they lost their homes. They were separated from their families. They lost their businesses. They never saw a judge. They never saw a jury. They had no charges preferred against them. Does this sound familiar? He hadn't yet coined the phrase enemy combatant. but they were locked up for the remainder of the war, starting in mid-1942. In 1980, a Republican president, strike that, in 1988, a Republican president and a Democratic Congress would enact the Civil Liberties Act of 1988, which Ronald Reagan happily signed. It condemned the wartime incarcerations of FDR. It declared that it is the policy of the American government never to incarcerate someone on the basis of their race or their religion or their national ancestry. It provided financial compensation for those who were still living. $20,000, big deal, but it was something, and there weren't too many still living. It was the first public apology the government made, and typical of the government, it took it 45 years to apologize for one of the most blatant, obvious violations of human liberty because a cowed Supreme Court went along with it. Now, all of this brings us into the modern era. While all of this is happening, the Fourth Amendment is still being enforced, meaning, for the most part, if the government wants information about you or from you, it must go to a judge and present evidence of probable cause of a crime. And if the judge agrees, I used to take these applications myself in the living room of my home at 3:30 in the morning. And sometimes they wouldn't tell me everything I needed to know, and I said, goodbye, guys, I'm not signing the search warrant. And sometimes I found out weeks and even years later that they didn't tell me everything, and then I signed documents to invalidate the search warrant that I signed in my home 2 years earlier at 3:30 in the morning. For the most part, this system of following the Fourth Amendment worked, and the government followed it. Until 1977, under the administration of Jimmy Carter, when the country is reeling from Watergate and disgusted with Nixon, and the Congress wants to do something about it. So the Congress wrote the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. You hear about this every day today by its acronym, FISA, F-I-S-A. FISA said that if the target is an agent of a foreign government, then you don't need the probable cause of a crime that the Fourth Amendment required. It's 200 years after the Fourth Amendment becomes law, and the government is officially wearing away at it. It says you only need probable cause that the target is an agent of a foreign government. But even this Congress, disrespectful of the Fourth Amendment as it was, and even Jimmy Carter, as big as he was into big government, nevertheless recognized if some evidence was obtained under one of these FISA warrants, it couldn't be used in a criminal prosecution because it was obtained inconsistent with the Fourth Amendment. The Fourth Amendment requires probable cause of a crime. FISA requires probable cause that the target is an agent of a foreign government. Once FISA issues the warrant, then the government can listen to the conversation of the foreign agent. Example, if it turns out that the janitor in the Soviet embassy is really a spy who beats his wife, he cannot be prosecuted for domestic violence because the information was obtained from a FISA warrant, inconsistent with the Constitution, and he can't be prosecuted for espionage because the information was obtained from a FISA warrant, inconsistent with the Constitution. The only thing the government could do is deport him. In 1978, not satisfied with the lessening of the probable cause standard, the Congress enacted something called the Right to Financial Privacy Act. Well, you know what's coming. You know the way the government names these statutes. If it has the word privacy in it, bet the mortgage you're going to lose some privacy. The Right to Financial Privacy Act brought us full circle to the Writs of Assistance Act, because this abominable statute permits government agents to write their own search warrants and to serve them on financial institutions. The target is limited to a financial institution, and the custodian of the financial institution must tell you about it. So if an FBI agent decides to write a self-written search warrant on the bank where Nick Gillespie deposits his billions, the bank would be required to say, hey, Nick, there's a guy here. He's from the FBI. He gave us a self-written search warrant. We're going to comply with it in about 10 days, but you have 10 days to challenge it, to go to a judge and say, what is this nonsense about a self-written search warrant? I have my Fourth Amendment rights. That was the rule set down in the Right to Financial Privacy Act. But even the big government people who disrespected the Constitution, who hated the Fourth Amendment, who wrote the Right to Financial Privacy Act, understood that any evidence obtained from one of these self-written search warrants could not be used in a prosecution against the target, in my hypothetical, the great and the wonderful and the handsome and the devilish. You want me to keep going? Nick Gillespie. Because the evidence was obtained on less than probable cause of a crime, it was obtained inconsistent with the Fourth Amendment. All of this sets the table for 9/11. Now, wherever you were on 9/11, you cannot forget or underestimate or overstate the catastrophe that occurred to the 3,000 human beings that died, to the American psyche, to our feeling that we are free and will always be free and no one can take our freedom away, to the government and to the Constitution. Because the government's initial reaction was to author the most abominable piece of legislation since the Alien and Sedition Acts, with the most unlikely of names, the Patriot Act. The Patriot Act is the most dastardly direct assault on human liberty and on guaranteed rights in the Constitution that the Congress ever enacted since the Alien and Sedition Acts 200 years earlier. The Patriot Act was enacted with no debate on the floor of the House of Representatives. Ask your member of Congress how much time he or she spent reading the Patriot Act. I've read it. I've read it twice. It's 315 pages long. But in order to read it, you must have with you and in front of you the entire United States Criminal Code, because the Patriot Act doesn't read like a novel or like a nation of sheep. The Patriot Act says, on page 362, change the semicolon to a comma. On page 467, change the word or to and. Change 15 to 10. So in order to read this, I'm just giving you hypotheticals here, you must insert the language from the Patriot Act into the many, many volumes of the United States Criminal Code before you can actually figure out what the Patriot Act says. The Patriot Act was posted on the House of Representatives intranet. That's their internal internet that only members of Congress and their senior staff have access to. And the House members were told they had 15 minutes to vote on this dastardly assault on human liberty. Well, what did the Patriot Act do? Why am I so animated about it, whether there was debate or not? Nobody in the House read it. Two members of the Senate read it. One of them is dead. Congressman Paul Wellstone said he read it, he's dead. It's Congressman or Senator Russ Feingold has stated publicly that he read it. The two people that read it, of course, voted against it. Nobody else read it in its entirety. The Patriot Act allows the FBI, your FBI, those men and women sworn to protect the Constitution, to invade your home while you're at a basketball game on a Friday evening or a football game on a Saturday afternoon or church on a Sunday morning and make it look like it was a robbery. Well, what is this? You call the local police and say, my house has been broken into? The last people in the world you would suspect would do that would be your local FBI, but they can do it. And they can plant a listening device on your bedpost or under your kitchen table or in your shower or anywhere in your house that they want without taking anything. By the way, if they want, they could also take your checkbook, because they may want financial information about you and you not knowing that you have it. And if they serve one of those self-written search warrants under the Patriot Act on your bank, let's continue with our hypothetical with Nick Gillespie. They now, after October 15, 2001, send a self-written search warrant, No judge is involved. Forget about the Fourth Amendment, the president has said. It takes too much time. Too much time to preserve human liberty. Too much time to remember these are natural rights, as natural as the fingers on the ends of our hands. But the Patriot Act says if the self-written search warrant is served on Gillespie's bank, it is a crime for the bank to tell him. Wait a minute. What about the First Amendment that says Congress shall make no law? What about the Fourth Amendment that says if you want evidence from someone, you got to go to a judge? The Patriot Act wipes that out. Not only may the evidence be used, remember Carter and his buddies when they wrote FISA, when they wrote the Right to Financial Privacy Act in 77 and 78, says right in the statute, can't be used as evidence in a criminal case. The Patriot Act says whatever is obtained from one of these self-written search warrants must be used as evidence. The first time I've seen that in any statute I've ever read, must be used and must be admitted as competent evidence in a criminal case. So the Patriot Act brings us full circle from the reasons for which, at least the last straw about which, we broke away from the mother country. The king and the parliament told the British soldiers they could write their own search warrants and use the fruits of those warrants against us in a criminal prosecution. And the Congress has told not just the FBI, but all federal agents, that they can write their own search warrants, serve them on a financial institution, use the evidence obtained against you, and make it a crime for the financial institution to tell you. It's even a crime for the custodian, the person at the financial institution, to tell anyone that he or she has received a self-written search warrant. So the banker can't tell her husband, her lawyer, her significant other, a priest in the confessional booth, can't even tell a judge in a federal court. That's why these challenges, when there are challenges, are always John Doe or Mary Roe versus John Ashcroft or Alberto Gonzalez. Because if you file a complaint with your real name on it, 5 years in a federal prison, and the evidence is right there. You broke the law. You revealed that an FBI agent knocked on your door and handed you a self-written search warrant. Even the Patriot Act, however, as abominable as it is, limited the targets of self-written search warrants to financial institutions. Now, 2 years later, on December 13, 2003, a day in which everyone in this room will remember where she or he was, the president signed an innocuous sounding, long, boring financial document into law, the Intelligence Authorization Act for fiscal 2004. Basically, this act provides appropriations from the General Treasury for the 16 intelligence agencies that we know about and the 2,000 intelligence agencies that we don't know about. I'm laughing. If we don't know about them, how would we know there's 2,000? We don't know what we don't know. Sounds a little Rumsfeldian, doesn't it? Tucked into the Intelligence Authorization Act for 2004 is a definition that would have made George Orwell proud. Remember FISA. Remember the Right to Financial Privacy Act. Remember even the Patriot Act. The target must always be a financial institution. So this abomination that the president signed into law on December 13, 2003, defines financial institution as follows: a bank, a trust company, a credit union. So far, okay. A delicatessen, a bodega, a restaurant, a hotel, a casino, a travel agency, your lawyer's office, your doctor's office, your telephone company, your computer server, and that great financial institution to which we will all repose our fortunes, the post office. So think about how Orwellian this is. The first three statutes say your target can only be a financial institution. This statute redefines financial institution to mean just about everything under the sun except your home. So now if an FBI agent or a federal agent from any of the federal agencies shows up with a self-written search warrant, they can read your mail before you do. They can see your medical records from your doctor, your HMO, your hospital, your pharmacist. They can find out what you ate at a restaurant, what you purchased at a supermarket, what you read that came in your mail. All of this without you ever knowing anything about it, and all of this without a federal judge ever involved. Whatever became of the right to be left alone? Oh, and December 13, 2003, why did the president sign it on that day? Because he knew that something happened 10,000 miles away which would so dominate and captivate the front pages that no one would notice this redefinition of the term financial institution until months, and he hoped years later. It was the day we captured Saddam Hussein. Who the heck is going to read a statute when that's dominating the headlines? It was actually a clerk for some federal agency discovered this and thought it was a mistake and put it on the wire services January 29th, a month and a half later, and we all read it and realized the monstrosity. How did your representatives in the Congress vote on this statute? You'll never know, because it was a voice vote. Assault the Constitution and don't even read what you're enacting. Change the natural meaning of human words and don't even record your vote on it, as if all of this isn't bad enough. In December of 2006, after they knew they had lost majorities in both houses of Congress, the Republicans and the president, with the complicity of some Democrats, enacted the Military Commissions Act of 2006. One would think that if one is tried for a crime and acquitted, found not guilty, one would be freed. The Military Commissions Act of 2006 gives the President of the United States power that even the great dictators of the 20th century never claimed to have, and that is the right to continue incarceration even after acquittal. Good God, how low have we let the government sink? I have called this book A Nation of Sheep because we act like sheep when we let the government steal our freedoms regularly, consistently, systematically, and repeatedly without even uttering a cry in protest. Now, not everything is lost. I don't want to ruin your appetites. There's a nice dinner about to come. Who has saved us from some of this? Believe it or not, those people who rail against activist judges should stop the railing. When the president said he could lock someone up and declare them an enemy combatant and throw away the key, not bring that person before a judge, not charge that person with a crime, not let them talk to a lawyer, not prosecute them, not give themselves a chance to defend themselves, the Supreme Court, by a vote of 8-1, said, no, you can't do that in this country. When the president's advisors said, take those bad guys to Guantanamo Bay. It's Cuba. It's not the United States. The criminal laws don't apply. You can torture and maim and do whatever you want. The treaties don't apply. The Constitution doesn't apply. And best of all, Mr. President, those pesky federal judges will leave you alone because they don't have jurisdiction over Cuba. Supreme Court rejected that argument by a vote of 6-3. The Military Commissions Act of 06 also took a lesson from Abe Lincoln, because you see, if the government swoops you up and you end up in Guantanamo Bay, where there's no jury and no independent judge and no right to look at all of the evidence against you, you have no right to habeas corpus. You cannot challenge the jailer and force the jailer to justify your confinement under the Constitution, a natural right that everyone in the Anglo-American world has had since 1215. Now, why has this happened? I suspect that it has happened because Americans are afraid. I think that FDR was one of the great socialists of all time, but during World War II, he preached hope and not fear. He preached that freedom would prevail. The administration that sits a couple of blocks from where we are now intimidates and scares and uses state secrets and secret evidence and shares it with members of Congress. And after they've looked at this stuff and God knows what it is, they come out and they vote to destroy the Constitution. Where is freedom? Freedom is in our hearts. If it dies there, forget it. No judge, no speech, no book, no cable TV, no legislature is going to bring it back. But if it lives in our hearts, no government can for very long keep it away. God love you.
Phrase in your introduction, which has entered our parlance in the past month or so, but really has been around for many, many years, since 1947, the deep state.
Right.
The part of the government that never changes, no matter which party controls Congress and which party is in the White House. There are many, many aspects of the deep state. We're talking about the intelligence community deep state. People in the intelligence community that have access to so much information about everyone, they can manipulate the President of the United States. And if they don't like what he says, they can embarrass him. And if they want to control his thought patterns and decision-making, they'll keep information away from him. Donald Trump has fallen victim to that, and he knows it, and he knows he has to stop it.
And this is his way of stopping it, by directly engaging on the issue, by saying exactly what, by the way, is inferentially provable throughout. Whether it be the reporting of the New York Times, the National Review, hardly a Trump booster. Let me tell you,
his suggestion for a congressional investigation of the intelligence community is the last thing his enemies in the intelligence community want. Because if the American public learns that they have access to everything we type and everything we say, they will be repulsed by the power that this deep state group has, that Congress gave them. They didn't create this on their own. Right. Congress enacted three pieces of legislation, which, with perverse interpretations of this legislation before a secret court, lets them gather everything we say in real time.
Is there any doubt in anyone's mind? Have we got a list of the number of instances in which the Obama administration has gone beyond the pale in surveilling, in tapping phones, in reading computer data and messaging? We do not have that.
They tapped the phones of our colleague, Jimmy Rosen, and eventually admitted that they were wrong when Rosen exposed them.
And journalists of the Associated Press. And people forget this. Dianne Feinstein, then the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, in 2014, they are still looking at the reality. The CIA went in and surveilled the computers of the Senate and Intelligence Committee.
You had spies spying on each other.
Well, yes, but what you had was the executive branch and the CIA spying on the Senate of the United States, which is beyond any kind of acceptable
behavior.
If you'll surveil journalists, if you will spy on U.S. senators, why would they hesitate to spy the Obama administration on a presidential candidate?
Great argument. Throw in generals in the Pentagon and justices in the Supreme Court. One of the FISA court warrants that I saw was, quote, for every customer of Verizon in the United States. That's 113 million people, including most of the federal government.
The metadata that the NSA was collecting under precisely that direction. It's unbelievable. But less so, I think, these days, because we are just seeing example after example. Going back to the judge's reference to the deep state, what we're looking at is a deep state that goes well beyond the intelligence community, but also now, for the first time, has in prospect the active leadership of the immediate predecessor to the Oval Office, and that is Barack Obama, who's bringing his leadership,
right,
that of many of his administration, and the Organization for Action with an estimated more than 30,000 activists.
But the deep state has a very wide and shrewd adversary,
mm-hmm,
the man in the Oval Office.
You better
believe
it.
The first time the modern era that the man in the Oval Office has been an adversary of the deep state and rather than a tool of it.
Absolutely. Well said, as always, Judge Andrew Napolitano. Good to have you.
Well, we've got a treat this afternoon. For our mystery speaker for 2010, on the 25th anniversary of the Mises University, we bring you a man who is famous, but will be more famous still, a man who has accomplished so much through his writing and his extraordinary speaking, but will accomplish even more, a man who was a champion of civil liberties, of peace, of free markets, but will be an even greater champion in years to come. Help me welcome our most extraordinary speaker, a man who, by the way, makes normally huge speaking fees, but is coming here today as a gift to the Mises Institute and to you. Help me welcome this great man.
I never got a reception like that in the courtroom. Lou Rockwell is a giant in the freedom movement, and each of you are budding giants, and I'm absolutely thrilled and delighted to be here. I was worried that if you didn't say who I was, you might not recognize me. And as you may know, my show for this Friday, Lou and I just taped together. He drove before the sun came up this morning to Montgomery to get to a television studio. I thought that I would talk to you a little bit about the Constitution, about how it interacts with our everyday lives, about how it affects the relationship of the government to the individual. And then I thought we'd get into a little conversation ourselves. I should be able to read some of your name tags, and maybe I'll call on you for a couple of questions and you can respond and we can get a nice dialogue going. Some men say the earth is round and some men say it is flat. But if it is round, can a command of the parliament make it flat? And if it is flat, could the king order it to be round? These are the words used by St. Thomas More in defense of himself, representing himself in his own trial for high treason, in which he was accused, of course, of refusing to acknowledge that the king was the head of the church on earth. We all know the outcome. The government separated his head from the rest of his body. But when he was making this argument to the jury, he was, of course, appealing not only to their common sense. Of course, the parliament couldn't make a round earth flat. And of course, the king couldn't make a flat earth round. He was also appealing to their understanding of the natural law, of the order in things, of the way a divine creature or a force of nature, whether you are religious or secular, created things, and of our need to pursue happiness by complying with the law of nature. He knew what Aristotle and Augustine and Aquinas had written. He could almost anticipate what Locke and Jefferson would write. And Locke, of course, would repeat this, and Jefferson would repeat this as well, that we have natural rights, that they come from our humanity, that they don't come from the government. At least those were the arguments that were made by these wonderful people who advanced this argument of the natural law. When we were a colony, when we were colonies, and the king and the parliament had wanted to raise money, they had ingenious ways of doing so. One of the most offensive was the Stamp Act, Parliament enacted a law that required every piece of paper in your home, every book, every pamphlet, every legal document, even a poster you were going to nail to a tree, have the king's image on it. You think it's rough going to the post office today? You had to go to a foreign post office and buy an image of the king. Question: how did the king and the parliament, 3,000 miles away, know if you had in your home the king's image and every piece of paper? Answer: Parliament enacted an abomination called the Townshend Acts, which authorized British soldiers to write their own search warrants. So a British soldier would show up at your house and knock on the door and hand you a piece of paper in which he had authorized himself to come in, ostensibly to look for the stamps. But of course, while there, they might help themselves to food, to alcohol, to furniture. They might even help themselves to the house, which is why we have the Third Amendment, which prohibits quartering troops in a private home against the wishes of the owner. The Stamp Act was really the last straw. It was the only one of the oppressive acts that Parliament actually repealed in an effort to quell the colonists from their rebellious ways. We fought a revolution. We won the revolution. We wrote a constitution. In 1787, they had a great debate, and the debate went back to what Moore said at his trial and what Locke had written and what Aristotle, Augustine, and Aquinas had written. Where do our liberties come from? Do they come from our humanity, or do they come from the government? Hamilton and the big government people at Philadelphia in 1787 said there can be no freedom without government. Government protects freedom, and government knows when to restrict it and when to expand it. And as long as the government is subject to the will of the people, as long as the majority rules, freedom will be safe. Jefferson, who wasn't there but argued through Madison, and Madison directly argued that this was nonsense, that our freedom comes from our humanity, that our right to think as we wish, to say what we think, to publish what we say, to worship or not to worship, our right to defend ourselves, our right to keep and bear arms, our right to life, to liberty, to the pursuit of happiness, our right to be left alone. After the right to life, that's my favorite, the right to be left alone, that these rights come from our humanity. And rights either come from our humanity by virtue of the force of nature or are gifts from God. As he created us in his own image and likeness, as he is perfectly free, we are perfectly free. The argument went back and forth. If you read Madison's notes, if you read Max Farrand, if you read any of the standard works which quote the debates in Philadelphia, we didn't win all those debates. We have a constitution that does have a Bill of Rights in it. It doesn't grant power. It restrains the government from exercising power. The Bill of Rights was written to restrain the federal government. Ultimately, it would be used in almost all instances to restrain all government. But there are majoritarian impulses in the Bill of Rights which undermine the notion that our liberties come from our humanity. So let's think of a few of them. Everybody knows this phrase: Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. What's the most important word? The. Why? It represents the understanding of the drafters that the freedom of speech preexisted the government. It preexisted them. It already existed before they assembled in 1787. It reflected, in the simplest of ways, their understanding that the freedom of speech did not come from anything they wrote or created in 1787, but rather was being recognized by them as something that they and their successors must respect. And so the First Amendment gives us the restraint on the Congress with respect to expressive liberties. Fast forward a couple of years, we have the presidency of John Adams. During the course of the French Revolution, when the government is afraid of the French. And as a result of this bizarre fear of French people, the government enacts the Alien and Sedition Acts, which basically says if you are French, you have to live here for 14 years before you can become a citizen. It also says if you bring the president or the Congress into disrepute, you can be prosecuted for a felony. How could the same generation, in some instances, the very same human beings who wrote, "Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech," also author something as abominable as the Alien and Sedition Acts? Lou Rockwell and I have spent a lot of time talking about this, and he reminds me of what Augustine wrote about when he talked about libido dominandi. Now, don't get excited. We all have libido. We all know what that is. This is a different kind of libido. This is this is the lust to dominate. This is the thing in human nature that draws people to the government. Regrettably, there are far too few Ron Pauls in the government and far too many people that suffer from this libido dominandi, this urge to dominate. So Congressman Matthew Lyon, an anti-federalist, a Jeffersonian from Vermont, thought that he would test the limits of the Alien and Sedition Acts. And he argued in public that John Adams, who was into puffery and pomp and circumstance and frills and wore almost regal-like clothing, in fact, was more interested in pomp and circumstance than the government. That wasn't quite enough to provoke the Justice Department. But John Adams had a little problem with his waistline. I can understand that. And Congressman Lyons referred to the president as his rotundity. And that was the last straw for the Justice Department. So Congressman Lyons was indicted and charged as a sitting member of Congress. He didn't say it on the floor of the Congress. You know, if he had said it on the floor of the Congress, he couldn't be prosecuted because of a clause in the Constitution that insulates members of Congress from legal action against them for what they do and say on the floor. Patrick Kennedy was caught driving drunk at 3 o'clock in the morning and collided with a tree. Argued that he was on his way to the floor of the Congress at that hour and therefore couldn't be prosecuted for DUI. The Constitution, constitutional protection of members of Congress doesn't go that far, but it does protect them for what they say on the floor. Congressman Lyons did not make this statement on the floor. He was charged, prosecuted, tried, and convicted of violating the Alien and Sedition Acts for making fun of the president's waistline. Now, if you're from New Jersey or New Orleans or Boston, you'll appreciate the second part of this story. Congressman Lyons ran for re-election from his jail cell, and he won. Eventually, of course, he returns to Congress. The Alien and Sedition Acts expire. They were sunset. Jefferson, of course, as the vice president, wasn't even protected by them. As you remember how presidents were elected in those days, everybody ran for president. Whoever finished first became president in the Electoral College. Whoever finished second became vice president. So you had the big government, somewhat overweight, pompous John Adams, the Federalist, and the very slim icon of liberty, Thomas Jefferson, the anti-Federalist, as the vice president. Imagine the bizarre combinations today had this not been changed shortly after the calamitous election of 1800. So back to the debate in 1787. We'll look for a minute at the authoritarian impulses in the Constitution through the prism of property rights. We'll start with this premise from Hayek. If you accept the premise that individuals exist for the greater good of society or the nation, then all the horrible experiences of totalitarianism are logical and will follow. Question: does the Constitution of the United States preserve, protect, and defend individual natural rights, or is it an instrument for totalitarianism? Now, you can answer this, I would argue, either way. We'll take the bad side for a moment. The argument is over eminent domain. When the king was the king in Great Britain, and he wanted property for his own purposes, he took it. He didn't have to pay for it. He didn't have to go to court. He just took it. Sometimes they would give the owner of the property some cash so that the owner would go away and leave the property peacefully. But the king, as the sovereign, had this power just to take the property. Fast forward to 1787, and they're trying to decide what to do with property rights, this new government that we're creating. Should it be able to take property? Madison, no. Jefferson, no. The only legitimate exchange of property for value is one that is truly voluntary. The individual is the highest good. The individual doesn't exist for the country. The country exists to protect the property rights of the individual. Jefferson and Madison's argument. Hamilton's argument is the one that the king made. Well, listen, we've got to build roads and canals. We've got to expand westward. We need a central bank. We need paper money. We're going to be able to have to take property. Why should we have to pay for it? It's the taxpayers' dollars anyway. So this argument went back and forth, and they crafted the Fifth Amendment. You could argue that the Fifth Amendment is a compromise. You could argue that it permits the exaltation of the state over the individual. It recognizes the right of the government to take whatever real property it wants, but it gives the owner of that property a jury trial and lets a jury decide what the value of the property is. And that's called eminent domain. So question, that right in the Fifth Amendment of the government to take property, does that, as Hayek warned us, manifest the belief that individuals exist for the greater good of the nation? I would argue, regrettably, that it does. That if we truly are free, then our property is truly our own, and we can exclude anyone from it, even the government. That's not radical. That was the idea of most of the founders when they were breaking away from the king. And if you read what Jefferson wrote in the Declaration of Independence, those were his ideas as well. So the Fifth Amendment is an imperfect compromise. By establishing eminent domain, it establishes the prior right of the central government to take whatever property it wants. And in an eminent domain case, and I've tried these as a judge, the issue is not, what does the government want the property for? The only issue is, what is the value of the property? I remember trying a case once where the government took a farmer's field in order to deposit debris on the field from a highway that they were building. This highway was about 65 or 70 miles from New York City. The debris was about 800 or 900 feet high. It was a mountain in the farmer's backyard. And the government wanted to argue to the jury that if the farmer climbed to the top of the mountain, he'd be able to see New York City. So therefore, the debris that they had deposited on his property actually enhanced its value. Unfortunately for them, I was the judge, and I wouldn't even let them make that absurd argument. But that's the lengths to which the government will go. But the issue of whether or not the government can do this, that is, take the backyard, it was an enormous backyard, it was 35 or 40 acres, and fill it with debris, was never even reached. In an eminent domain case, property first, decision later. Property first, decision later. The government gets the property, and then the courts decide later what it's worth. We know from the Kelo case that this has truly been distorted now. The Fifth Amendment at least has in its protection public use. That's now become public benefit. And Kelo says that a public benefit can be more tax dollars in the tax collector's coffers. How could that possibly be a benefit to give them more money to spend? You're at home one night, there's a knock on the door. You open the door, there's a guy with a gun. The guy says to you, give me your money. I want to give it away in your name. You call the police. You find out he is the police. Now, if we wouldn't let a crackpot like that come into our living room to take our cash to give it away in our name, why would we let the government do that? When I tell this story and I argue that taxation is theft, my buddy Stossel says, you're killing me, you're killing me. I said, John, what do you mean I'm killing you? He said, well, when you say things like taxation is theft, and the people that listen to you roar and love to hear you say it, my people say to me, well, John, why don't you say what Judge Napolitano says? I shouldn't tell stories by myself. I'm awed at the reception that you've given me and utterly delighted to be here. This is the greatest academic institution on the planet for the study of human freedom, bar none. and you are all fortunate to be here. Still hear me. This device is working. Okay. So we'll start with a couple of questions. Somebody want to make the argument, Jessica, that Hamilton was right and that without a government, there can be no property rights and no liberty. And so we have to have the government to protect those property rights. The floor is yours.
Whoa.
All right, I'll help you out a little bit. This is, by the way, this is the way law school is taught. The professor goes up and says, "Todd, tell me why the court was wrong in Marbury against Madison." "Oh, but professor, I just studied it. I can tell you what they said." "Yeah, but I want you to rip it apart." "All right, you have a seat. I don't want an emotional problem here. University of Oklahoma, John Chancey, make Hamilton's argument. Make him sound good."
"That's impossible."
"Give it your best shot."
"It's a natural right given to us by the fact that we are human."
"How do humans have this natural right?"
"Creator."
"No,
I'm glad that somebody said the creator, because you should be able to make both of these arguments. You should be able to make a religious argument and a secular argument. Here's the secular argument. I own my own body. I own what my body produces. I own the ideas that comes out of it. I own what I produce with the sweat of my brow. I own the thoughts that I express. I own the property and wealth that I accumulate. Or I was created in the image and likeness of an all-knowing, all-loving God who is perfectly free. And as I am in his image and likeness, I have the freedom that he gave to me." Those two arguments meet at the position of true north. I shouldn't have both microphones. Hold that for me, Ted. And true north is the position that everybody in this room accepts, which is the primacy of the individual over the state. Obviously, we accept that as the starting point from which we study political philosophy, economic philosophy, and the relationship of the government to the individual. Who's got the microphone? All right, keep it, Ted. Why does the government reject that argument?
Well, the government rejects the argument because they feel as though we would take those rights from each other if we didn't have someone to keep us in line and protect them for us.
Is the government more interested in our freedom or its own power?
Well, it wouldn't be able to exercise its ability to protect our freedoms if it didn't have complete power over us, so I would say it's much more interested in its own power.
How did it get this way? How did we get a government which can only pay lip service to the Constitution? I was interrogating this congressman from South Carolina, Jim Clyburn, the number three ranking Democrat in the House, about health care. And I said, "Congressman Clyburn, very simple, declaratory, basic question. Where in the Constitution is the federal government authorized to manage health care?" He looked at me as if I had three heads and said, "Judge, most of what we do down here," I was in New York, he was in Washington, through the magic of Fox, it looked like we were in the same room, most of what we do down here is not authorized by the Constitution. Now, we all laugh at that, everybody does every time I relate it, and you may give him some credit for his honesty, but it's reprehensible. "Congressman, do you remember that you took an oath to uphold the Constitution?" "Yes. But you tell me," he says, to continue the conversation, "where in the Constitution it is prohibited." I'm just going to walk down the aisle. So there we are, Matthew. "Where in the Constitution it is prohibited for the federal government to manage health care." Now, that is the more serious of the two confessions, because that reveals an utter misunderstanding of the Constitution and the nature of limited government. If he thinks that the federal government can do everything except that which is prohibited, then it can do almost anything it wants. In fact, of course, the federal government is limited if the Constitution means what it says, unless it's this sneaky majoritarian document intended to create totalitarianism when we have a dictator like Lincoln or Franklin Roosevelt or even his cousin Theodore, or the guys that have been in the White House in the past couple of terms. You'll have to decide for yourself whether the Constitution was written to permit that.
But we know that at least as you read it, it is one of limited powers. Do you remember Reagan's first inaugural address? I know you do. Who has the microphone? All right. In Reagan's first inaugural address in the third paragraph, I know you remember what he said. The states formed the federal government. Do you remember what he said?
The states formed the federal government.
And not the other way around. Now, if your humble temporary professor had been the author of that speech, I would have added, and the power which the states gave to the central government, they can take back. They can even nullify. Forgive me, those of you who are my generation, this is the smartest guy in the room. They can even nullify what the federal government does, as you know, a concept readily accepted, articulated in the Declaration of Independence. If we can separate from Great Britain, why can't the part of the country that hates the central government separate from the rest? Makes sense to you?
Makes perfect sense.
Okay. Anybody else want to throw anything out at us? Sir?
Judge, I think you're an anarchist and you don't know it yet.
Do you hear me denying anything? I thought there was going to be a follow-up. You know, I have argued, some of you have heard what I've said, and some of you have read what I've written, and some of you have seen me with Lou Rockwell and with Tom Woods, that the government exists for only one purpose, and that is to preserve our freedom. And everything else that the government does is illegitimate, immoral, not authorized by the Constitution. When I was having this argument with Congressman Clyburn, I made the Reagan statement that the young lady just reminded us what he said in his first inaugural address. But it was like talking to a stone. I mean, the Congress is so enamored of its own power. He even said to me, "You know, Judge, we sometimes write laws, we don't care if they're unconstitutional. We leave it to you and your buddies with black robes to decide if it's unconstitutional, and we win either way. If you say it is constitutional, we got a piece of the pie home. If you say it's not constitutional, we tried to get a piece of the pie home, and the voters will reward us." Now, Jefferson and Hamilton agreed on very little in their lives, but the one thing they did agree on is when the public treasury becomes a public trough, and when the public recognizes that, it will only send to Washington people who will give it the larger piece of the pie. And then nobody's liberties will be safe if the government takes the attitude that it can take whatever it wants. So then I said to Congressman Clyburn, "Well, you know, you want the federal government to micromanage health care. How well does the federal government do managing anything else?" And he said to me, "What do you mean?" I said, "Well, Medicare broke, Medicaid broke, Social Security broke, the Post Office broke, Amtrak broke, the Defense Department broke. When the Mustang Ranch in Nevada was taken over by the IRS for failure to pay income taxes and the government ran it, they bankrupted it." So let me get this straight, Congressman Clyburn. The government can't provide booze and hookers to truckers in the desert, and they want to manage health care. He Here's a little bit of good news, and it follows from the silly example I just gave. I don't think I could have made arguments like this in public 10 years ago or maybe even 5 years ago. If there's any silver lining in the dark cloud of totalitarianism consuming Washington and extending its tentacles into our pocketbooks and our private lives, it is that the argument for freedom is more compelling. The argument for freedom is reaching more people. The argument for freedom can be made in more public forums. I mean, Ron Paul was at one time a fringe candidate who was laughed at even by some of my colleagues at Fox. Oh my God, when they excluded him from that fourth Republican debate, Fox got over 175,000 emails, and every single one of them was copied to me. Just imagine what that does to your inbox. But the argument for freedom, made so articulately by Congressman Paul, the rest of us try to make the argument that he makes on the national scale, resonates with so many young people and resonates with so many even middle-class people, not the beneficiaries of the education that each of you have had, that Lou Rockwell has had, that Tom Woods has had, that I was privileged to have, simply because the government has become so overbearing, so overweening, so disrespectful of the Constitution, so lacking in any self-limitation, that the argument for freedom is one that you can make more openly, more broadly, and it resonates more effectively than at any time that I can think of. The last time I remember arguments like this was probably before almost each of you was born. We had a classic debate in this country in 1964 when Barry Goldwater ran against Lyndon Johnson. And Goldwater had authored a book called The Conscience of a Conservative. Don't shy away from it, because a conservative then was a classic. It was what we would call ourselves today. It's a wonderful book. There's some bizarre stuff about foreign policy, but basically about the nature of the relationship of the federal government to the states and to the individuals. It's articulated brilliantly. That's the last time I can remember public debates about the Constitution like we have now. But the statements by Congressman Clyburn are so deeply troubling because they have been accepted by so many people. I'll give you an example. I was interviewing Governor Palin on my show, and I asked her the following question. Governor, you were the victim of a email hacker. He hacked into your computer, got your personal records. The government prosecuted him, tried him, and convicted him. Yes, right. Question, Governor, should the government be able, hang on to that, John, should the government be able to hack into your email without a search warrant from a judge? Well, of course not. And any statute or any law in the books that says that it can's got to come right off those books. Seated next to me, she was in Utah on a screen about this size in the studio. Seated next to me was Congressman Paul, who said, I'm one of just 16 Republicans that voted against the Patriot Act. He could have said, but he's a gentleman and didn't, that she campaigned for when she ran with John McCain. So, does a person's attitude about freedom change when they are the victim? Or did she not know that the Patriot Act authorizes federal agents to write their own search warrants? You can decide for yourself which is the appropriate answer. But that phrase, combined with one I'll tell you about in a moment, went viral. You know, a lot of people picked it up all over the internet because, you know, Palin attacks the Patriot Act. Then I said to her, Governor, is it any business of the government what chemicals we put into our bodies when we are at home, in the privacy of our homes, and when no one is harmed by it? And she goes, you talking about marijuana? Yes. I don't think it should be legal, but I don't think it should be prosecuted.
What?
Right. What is exactly what I said. That, of course, went viral. Palin in favor of legalization of marijuana. sometimes when you present arguments in a way that that emphasize the ignominy of the government and natural freedoms, people will accept those arguments, forgive me, without even realizing what they're saying. I don't know what her thoughts were when she said that, but if you are before groups or in front of the camera, you need to understand ways to make these arguments so that the government is shown as the destroyer of freedom that it is, and the individual is shown as being having primacy over the government. Now, it's not always easy to do that. I spend about every Sunday afternoon, I don't have the time to do this during the week, so I have somebody on my staff make a copy, download everything that's on lewrockwell.com. And my favorite part of the week is Sunday afternoon, just going through two thick loose leaves, because I don't like to read it on the screen, of everything that's on there. You know this because you're all here. These are just some of the greatest arguments for human freedom that you can imagine. They're treats, from Murray, Rothbard, to Hayek, to Lou himself, to Tom Woods, to a lot of people all over the country that share and enjoy the ideas that we do and help you to make your point. So, how many ways are there to earn wealth? I can think of three. One is the inheritance model. You're fortunate enough to have inherited a lot of money. God bless you. Spend it as you want. The other is the economic model, which is what most of us use. You work hard. You trade a skill, knowledge, sweat of your brow, the work of your muscles, the creation of your brain, to somebody else who pays you for it. And the third is the intimidation model. Your money or your life? Which model does the government use? It's not even a close call. So when you can explain things like that, I learned a lot of this from Woods, when you can explain things like that, people understand exactly what's happening here. You may not talk about the majoritarian impulses of the Fifth Amendment. If you're a scholar of the Constitution, you know exactly what I'm talking about. But when you tell people the government can take anything it wants from you, no matter how badly you want to keep it, as long as it throws an adequate amount of money at you, most people would object to that. If you go up to somebody and say, do you want to live your life as you wish, or do you want the government to tell you how to live it? Now, that's a question that really only has one answer. I don't even know how Congressman Clyburn would answer a question like that. But you have to confront the adversary and put that question to them and bring these things that government does to us right down to the basics of who makes the decisions in our lives. All right, questions. You ready to make Hamilton's argument? Not yet. All right, we'll get there. Yes, in the pink shirt, right here. What'd you do, shave with a credit card this morning? I'm just being a wise guy. Go ahead.
Judge, when the principle of freedom and the Constitution, when they conflict, which one should be paramount to U.S. justices who swore to uphold the Constitution? What's more important, the freedom or the Constitution?
Almost everybody who was a judge in the country today would probably answer the Constitution. But I would argue that the Constitution embodies the natural law, and it is the duty of judges to uphold the natural law, no matter what the majority says. The whole purpose of an independent judiciary is to be the anti-democratic branch of government. What do I mean by that? The anti-democratic, lowercase d, branch of government. Wait a minute.
To be the...
Oh, they brought the mic. Thank you.
To be the branch of government that's not decided by majoritarian vote but has its own authority on what's right and wrong.
Why do we want an anti-democratic branch of government? I thought the majority rules, Joshua.
Because if the majority rules, it can steal the rights of the minority?
Precisely. Because if we did not have an anti-democratic branch of the government, there would be nothing to prevent the majority from taking the property or the freedom of the minority by a simple vote. Hitler was elected pursuant to the laws that existed in Germany at the time by some sort of a majority vote. No one could seriously argue that simply because the majority has voted for something that it is worthy of protection in our hearts or by the use, I'm getting back to your great question earlier, of our courts. So there should be no question in anyone's mind that the duty and the affirmative obligation of the courts is to protect natural liberty. Who on the Supreme Court of the United States today comes closest to doing this? Justice Thomas, and it's not even close. Unfortunately, he's only one of eight. Every once in a while, you'll hear something from my friend Nino, but for the most part, Justice Thomas is the only person who writes about, in judicial opinions, the natural law, and it is its restraint on the government. That's the beauty of the natural law when it is recognized, is it restrains everything except personal freedom.
Speaking of the Supreme Court, Judge, when President Paul nominates you to the Supreme Court, will you accept, and how will you handle the smell?
We haven't discussed it. Very flattering. Somebody else wants to stir the pot. Sir, Paul, pass that down to him. You're welcome. All right.
During the Constitutional Convention, when the Constitution was first ratified, the state delegates came over and they ratified the Constitution, which means, I think, that the federal government has power over the states, not the people in the states, correct? To a extent.
Here's what I would say, and I think it's a great argument. The third word of the Constitution is highly misleading. What is it? People. It was we, the states, that enacted the Constitution. It was not we, the people. The Constitution was ratified by ratification conventions in each state. It didn't matter whether a state had 50 ratifiers or 10,000 ratifiers. Until the Civil War, the federal government had next to no relationship to individuals. From and after the abominations of Reconstruction, when you needed in the South, right where we are now, permission from a federal military person to go to the post office, to be outside with your spouse, to play a game in public with your children, was a dictatorship for 10 years from 1865 to 1876, 11 years. The government began having a relationship with individuals. Lincoln enacted, the Congress enacted at Lincoln's instigation, legal tender laws. The Congress enacted an income tax, which eventually went away. But the presumption that the federal government had authority over individuals without a scintilla of authority in the Constitution for it was accepted. Why? Wartime. I once sang that Springsteen song on air, which of course got me a call from the second floor, which is where the executives of Fox are. War, war, what is it good for? The government. Because war is the health of the state. Because presidents... when they want your money and your freedom, will start a war. Lyndon Johnson practically acknowledged that in public with all of his gooey adulation of FDR and his willingness to emulate him. So this is sort of a long-winded answer. I mean, in the progressive era, with the destruction of states' rights and with the institution of the income tax, the 16th and the 17th Amendments, the federal government begins a very, very direct contact with individuals by going into your pocket, by thinking it can take as much as, oh, don't worry, the tax will never be more than about 3.5% or 5%, and it'll only affect the wealthiest people. At one point, it went up to 90%. So, you know, you give them that authority, and they'll take it. I am so offended by this amendment, which destroyed the ability of the states to send senators to the Congress and allowed the voters to elect them, that I think you can answer this bizarre-sounding question. Question. Is there any part of the Constitution that is unconstitutional? Answer, it is this amendment. It is the 16th Amendment that destroys the ability, takes the states away from the table of government. Here's the table of government. The people are there in the House of Representatives. The state is there in the president. The states are there in the Senate. Do you think Chuck Schumer would still be representing New York if the state legislature sent him there? Probably not, because most of what he does doesn't have anything to do with the power and independence and sovereignty of the state of New York. So that is an absolute abomination. As horrendous as the income tax is, it is that one in the progressive era that began the utter destruction of the tripartite system of government that the founders gave us. I can't see your name from this instance.
Matt.
Matt.
I just wanted your opinion on what if the founders...
Here you go, Matt.
All right, here you go. What if the Constitutional Convention had never ratified the Constitution and we'd still be with the Articles of Confederation? How would this nation, or how would this population grow? How would it be different than it is today, do you think?
We wouldn't have a Federal Reserve. We wouldn't have a president who thinks he can be a king. We wouldn't have a Congress that thinks it can write any law, regulate any activity, tax any event. We'd be happier and freer. I'm projecting, of course. You're asking me to rewrite 230 years of history.
I just wanted a brief, in other words, better or worse.
Oh, not even a close call. Look, I spend my professional life studying and defending the Constitution. But I didn't write it. I mean, I would have written a lot of different things, and the Articles of Confederation created a system of government which permitted the states to nullify, to tell the federal government to take a hike, which literally was based on the consent of the governed. All right, Jessica, let's see what you do with this one. Is the government based on the consent of the governed? Does the government get its power from the consent of the governed, or does it get it from some other source? Right.
Oh, it should.
Okay, so where's the microphone? Okay, suppose you don't consent. Does the government still have power over you?
I think now they do. I don't think that they should.
Well, good argument. Good argument. Yes, they do. They really don't care about your consent. So is the argument that the powers of the government are based on the consent of the government just a bunch of baloney made by politicians who want to steal your property and your freedom? Probably is. Sometime during his administration, George W. Bush claimed that he got powers as president from, this is crazy, from some source other than the Constitution. And when pressed, he couldn't name the source. Perhaps because it doesn't exist. But he didn't say from the consent of the governed. You know, if you read things, if you read portions of the Declaration of Independence, I've argued with people on air about this, who will say, oh, it was just Jefferson's musings. Well, he just wrote that to antagonize the king. He just put that down to rile people up so that they would rebel against Great Britain. All right, if you go to the U.S. Code, which is all the laws the Congress has ever written, it would fill bookshelves about this size, this whole corner here. Go to the first page of the first book, and what's there? The first law they ever adopted, the Declaration of Independence. Yet in New Jersey, when Woodrow Wilson was president, he had just been the governor of New Jersey, people were arrested for reading the Declaration of Independence out loud on public street corners, especially the part that says, when the government fails to protect your freedom, it is the duty of the people to alter or abolish it. How could you possibly be prosecuted for that? Wilson was, of course, a monster who brought the progressive era to us. I'm a graduate of Princeton University, where he is utterly revered. But his ideas that the federal government could write any law that it wanted and tell you how to live your life really was the progenitor of the big government we have today, I would argue even more so than FDR. Had there not been a Woodrow Wilson, again, I'm rewriting history here, there might not have been an FDR, or he might not have been as successful as he was. During World War I, the government enacted the Espionage Act, which made it a crime to discourage someone in the munitions industry from going to work, or to discourage someone who had been drafted from going into the military. What's the word? Discourage. So it punished speech. So Abe Gitlow an immigrant from Eastern Europe. You guys don't remember this, but when I was your age, before printers and laptops and Blackberries and all the gizmos and wizards we have today, if you wanted to get an idea out, even Woods is too young to remember this, you got an old-fashioned mimeograph machine. It was like a barrel filled with ink, and you put a stencil on the outside of it. If you turned it at the right speed and you caught the right amount of papers, the ink would seep through the cuts on the stencil and you could reproduce documents cheaply and in your home. So Abe reproduced a very crude pamphlet that basically said this World War I, then call it World War I, the Great War is insane and you shouldn't participate in it. You shouldn't help it in any way. And then he took these and he went to the top of the tenement in which he lived in Lower Manhattan and he hurled them into the streets. And 5 years later, he began serving a 20-year prison term for violating the Espionage Act by discouraging people from participating in the war effort. Government was not able to find anybody at trial who would come and testify that they saw, read, or understood Abe's leaflets. Abe, you see, didn't speak English, and he wrote them in Yiddish. And forgot that with the exception of his mother and mother-in-law, very few people around there even understood the language, much less the alphabet that was used for it. That is still a law today. When the New York Times revealed that the Bush administration was spying on us without warrants and lying about it, that brilliant Secretary of State, Alberto Gonzalez, threatened to prosecute them under the Espionage Act. The Alien and Sedition Act's expired. The Espionage Act is still there. Well, if the government gets its powers from the consent of the governed, who could possibly consent to the existence of a crime for discouraging people?
Anybody? Nobody?
So again, we go back to where we started. And it may be an unhappy argument, except that we're all very happy to be here. Is the Constitution an instrument that ultimately protects our freedom, that ultimately preserves the primacy of the individual over the state? Or is the Constitution an insidious instrument by which the majority can always get its way? And by majority, I don't mean the people that vote in November. I mean the Jim Clyburns, and the Republicans are just as bad at this as we know from the Bush administration. The Patriot Act was their creation. I mean the majority of those who run the government. Well, both, neither, either one. Look, this is like how many angels are on the head of a pin. We are not going to come to an answer to this now. I throw this out to you not to express any personal exasperation or any frustration with the document, but I throw it out to you because you ought to be thinking about these things. As well as each of you understands Austrian economics, you need to understand how the government came to exist, how the government operates, and what it claims it can do. Boy, if the world were filled with young people like this, we wouldn't have these things to worry about. Jefferson. Well, Jefferson was far, far from perfect. I mean, we all know about his personal life. At the same time, he wrote that all men are created equal. He probably was having a relationship with one of his 200 slaves, and she probably had 6 or 7 children by him. Who can imagine that her involvement with him was voluntary? And the Constitution, of course, as originally written, has 3 clauses in it that implicitly recognize slavery. So obviously, it is a flawed document. But if you take the Bill of Rights for what it is supposed to be, if you understand the Declaration of Independence as the protector, progenitor, explainer of our natural rights, and the Constitution of the United States as the explainer of how the government is supposed to protect those rights, these things should work well. They don't, and they haven't, because not enough people understand the ways in which government takes freedom away from people. when Justice Scalia was Judge Scalia, when Joe Biden was Senator Biden, they had the following discourse back and forth at Justice Scalia's confirmation hearings when President Reagan nominated him to the Supreme Court. Biden, well, would you read what we members of Congress say about legislation in order to discern what we mean by it? Scalia, no. Are you interested in what lawyers call legislative history and all the committee reports that we prepare whenever we enact any legislation, Judge Scalia? Scalia, no. Don't you want to know the reasons why we vote in favor of legislation to preserve the American people? Scalia, there's only one reason why you vote for anything, Senator Biden, to get reelected. It doesn't matter what you say. That's the only reason that you people in government do anything. What is it called? Libido dominandi. We're back to where we started. The lust to dominate. The only thing that these people fear is the loss of their power. Jefferson, when the people fear the government, there is tyranny. When the government fears the people, there is liberty. God bless you, my friends. Thank you. You're a good sport. Thank you. Good question. Thank you. Great question. Thank you. Thank you.